Well, I have always been interested in history, and I thought, and of course, also the history mystery, and I thought, what can I do that's different? Because I was, just in this time frame, I was looking to do something that's not been done before, and so I came up with the idea, maybe there was a young detective in early 1700s, a primitive detective agency. And this young man would come into contact with some of the criminals of the era, American in the New World and in Europe. And so it just went from there.
This is essentially a detective story set in New York City in 1702.
Right.
The portrait of the city that you give, and you render it vividly through the characters, is really quite remarkable.
Thank you. Well, started out researching maps in New York at the New York Public Library, and they have a great collection of maps. The deal was, since it's set, in 1702, but I couldn't find actually a 1702 map. I found a 1695 map and a 1730 map, and I sort of have to kind of extrapolate and put it together in my head what the city must have looked like in about 1702. Now, the 1695 map I have is it's very difficult to read. The street names, you can't really read the street names, so you just have to go with what you got. But the 1730 map is a beautiful map. Now, if I made any error in terms of the street names, it's probably because I was relying too much on that 1730 map. But anyway, I've done a lot of other research too, a tremendous amount of research, and hopefully, I know I've not got it right because I don't think you can get it right unless you absolutely lived in that era, but I think I've come pretty close to getting it right.
How did you come to set it in precisely the year 1702?
Well, since the first book in the series, Speaks of Nightbird, was set in 1699 to take advantage of the witchcraft trial in Salem, I needed to advance the character, but I didn't want to advance him that many years. I still wanted to be a young man. So he's 20 in Nightbird, and he's 23 in Queen of Bedlam. So that's why.
The queen in the book refers to an old woman who's locked away in a hospital.
Right.
Without giving away the plot,
right.
What is the significance of this
Well,
character?
there is a serial killer roaming New York, called The Masker. And I got a review, and somebody said, Oh, they really call their serial killers names. They gave their serial killers names. I don't know. So, The Masker is the name of the serial killer in New York. Matthew is investigating what's going on with The Masker. And it comes to his attention that there's a woman in this very primitive insane asylum in New Jersey that they call, because of her regal bearing, the Queen of Bedlam. And so she's reacted to a story in a broadside newspaper about the masker, but she doesn't speak. But she has made some reaction, and the doctors at this asylum contact Matthew because there's some question: does she know something about the masker? Does she know something about these murders in New York? And obviously she does, but you don't find that out until later. And that's basically the thrust of the book.
Certain parallels have been drawn between this character and Sherlock Holmes.
Oh yeah, well that's great. I'm glad to hear. Well,
Well,
Sherlock Holmes is one of my influences, of course. Because when I read Sherlock Holmes as a kid, and everybody reads, I hope everybody reads Sherlock Holmes as a kid. The atmosphere of those stories is so fantastic. But you're there. I mean, you really, really are there. The mysteries are great, the stories are great, but the atmosphere. And if you notice, every story starts out building an atmosphere. It builds an atmosphere. It says it's March, it's windy outside, it's April, the rain is coming down, it's hot summer, midsummer. So he sets, you're really right there, right at the beginning of the story. And I love that. And that's really what I set out to do also.
Well, there's also in this book, there is an arch villain who is not unlike Professor Moriarty.
Right, absolutely. Somebody said, you're not supposed to say this person's name. He's so evil, you're not supposed to say his names.
We'll take a chance. Go ahead.
Okay, his name is Professor Fell. I don't know his first name yet.
Yeah.
He has brought together the criminal families of Europe, and he is looking at the New World as being a fertile field for criminal endeavors.
So he was the first godfather in New York.
Absolutely. There you
Okay.
go. Actually,
Right.
he's still, well, is he in New York or not? You don't
Yeah.
know. You don't know if
Okay.
he's in New York or if he's in London or where he is,
Yeah.
So this series is gonna be of course I'm looking for the long term, 8 to 10 books probably.
Wow.
And so the theme and the story that ties these books together is Matthew is slowly going to be more and more in contact with Professor Fell, and it's going to be sort of a battle to the death between he and Professor Fell. And I guess I'm laying the cat out of the bag, but you know, this is what it's about. But that's going to be basically the theme in, as you go through the series.
I smell movie rights here.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. Wouldn't that be nice?
One of the more colorful characters in the book is Lord Cornbury, the governor of New York, who dresses in drag.
My research disclosed that there was a governor in 1702. In fact, he came that summer of 1702, the governor-mayor of New York, New Jersey, and he was a cousin to Queen Anne. And he...
And apparently wore hand-me-downs.
Well, he... when he did dress in his wife's clothes. And he walked around New York in his wife's clothes. And he said because he was cousin to Queen Anne, he was representing Queen Anne to the city. Now, he didn't always dress in women's clothes. But actually, one of the things that caught my attention is I read an article about his being picked up with prostitutes on what was known then as the Broadway. And I thought, you know, this is really bizarre. Prostitutes on the Broadway in 1702. You know, who'd have thunk it?
Not much has changed.
Well, that's the point. That's exactly the point. That really not much has changed. The city, of course, has changed, but people don't change that much. And to me, that's fascinating.
This character that you've created, Matthew Corbett, the young detective. He goes through quite a trial of fire in this book. He is. Beaten and stabbed and cut and suffers many indignations and survives. I'm just thinking by the end of the eighth book, he's going to need some really serious rehab.
Well, he was attacked by a bear in Nightbird, you know, and almost torn up by a bear. So
and he was attacked by birds.
He was attacked by hawks.
Raptors.
Raptors in this one. So I'm going to probably run out of animals to attack him with by the end of the series. But yeah, you know, the next one is a pretty rough one too. The first book, Nightbird, introduced Matthew. The Queen of Bedlam introduces his world, I think, more vividly. The next one, he has to get really, really tough, because it's a tough book. It's a darker. The next one's probably a darker book than either Bedlam or Nightbird.
Do we have a title for the book yet?
Mr. Slaughter.
I can only imagine.
You can imagine that.
The significance of the name.
Right. Right.
Let's talk about one of your other books for just a moment. Your book, Boy's Life, is a wonderful coming-of-age story set in a small town in Alabama. And it has reached such a level of distinction that it is now required reading in many schools around the country.
Right.
Talk about the success of that book.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me that the book continues to grow in popularity from year to year. You know, usually you do a book and you hope it does well, and then you kind of go to the next one, and that's great, you know, and that's old news. But, you know, you go to the next one. But Boy's Life it's got legs. It keeps going and keeps going. And I get so many letters. The deal about Boy's Life is what's fascinating to me is I get as many letters from elderly people as I do young people. I mean, so it just runs the gamut of readership. You get teenagers, you get people in their 80s who can relate to the story. And, you know, and I didn't really write it for a young audience. But the young audience has really picked up on it. And like you said, it is...
They identify with the characters.
Absolutely. And it's required reading in many, many high schools. As I understand, a teacher told me, because the students like to read it. They enjoy reading it.
Yeah.
So teachers are looking for something that the young readers, you know, can enjoy reading, and this really it suits them.
Recently, I read that you took a field trip down to Florida to defend Boy's Life before a school board. Tell us about that.
Well, I understood. Actually, I found out a couple of days before I went down that the book was on the list of books that were going to be banned from the school library. And I found out actually the day before the board was going to vote on banning the book or not, the day before I found out that it was going to happen. So I got on the plane that afternoon, went there that night, and spoke before the board. It was reinstated back to the school library. So, you know, thank goodness.
I read what you... what you said to them, and it was really very eloquent. Really
Thank you.
Spoken.
Well, you know, my feeling was that, as I explained to them, of course, the book was not really written for a young audience. So I can understand some of the points they had about the profanity. But as I pointed out, the profanity is used to mark people who are bad people. You know, they have a hopelessness about the world. They have a bitter view and bitter image of the world. And I pointed that out, and I think that carried some weight also.
Robert McCammon, thanks very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.